The mountains of West Virginia are beautiful, but sometimes terrifying to me in the same way that the ocean is terrifying. I remember the first time I went out into the Atlantic far enough for the land to be completely out of sight. No matter which way I turned, the expanse laid out before me seemed infinite. 10 miles from civilization might as well have been 1,000. I remember thinking, if I were lost out here, I would never make it home. After moving to West Virginia, I would often come up over the top of a ridge and look out over the sparsely populated 24,000 square miles of Appalachian forest that makes up the state. From these vantage points, the treetops appear connected, a sprawling blanket of life concealing everything beneath it. These mountains are among the oldest in the world, where you can stand on rock that is literally a billion years old. In the morning, a dense, translucent mist often settles along the ridges and valleys, making even the most familiar hills and hollows seem eerie and otherworldly. In the evenings, the tree cover darkens the forest beneath it before the sun has even set. Like the ocean, I sometimes look out over the landscape and think, if I were lost out here, I would never make it home. The story we're about to tell is an Appalachian murder mystery. When we're done here, you will have heard the most complete accounting yet assembled of West Virginia's most notorious murders. The story has all the cliché components of modern true crime: grisly homicides, incompetent policing, a false confession, probably, you can decide for yourself. But this is also not your typical whodunit. It's also about an assassination attempt, a psychic cult, student protests, an intersex child molester, ghost hitchhikers. But mostly, at its core, it's about two West Virginia college girls who never made it home. From Chromatic Media and the heart of Morgantown, West Virginia, this is Appalachian Mysteria, Season 1, the WVU Co-Ed Murders. Before we get to the story of Merritt and Karen's disappearance and decapitation, I need to take just a couple of minutes to introduce you to our guides for this epic journey.
Well, she talks about classes, but she's not specific.
Right.
I'm really curious.
I have Karen's class schedule.
How did you get it?
I got her notebook from the last...
Nice.
That's them, Sarah and Jeff, doing what they do, poring over this case. This was being recorded on our drive to a crime scene, but we'll get to that later. Suffice to say that Sarah and Jeff are both kind of obsessed with the mystery of Merritt and Karen. They're also probably two of the most knowledgeable people about this case still alive. I'd met Sarah first. We'd only hung out once or twice, and we were drinking on my front porch when, without any real prompting, she launched into this crazy, macabre story of murdered West Virginia University students, which seemed to get more incredible with each narrative turn. And at some point, I asked her whether she'd considered telling it to a wider audience, and here we are, co-producing this show. When I asked her early on to share with me the material she'd collected about the case to help map out the story for the podcast, she handed me an entire folder full of press clippings, photographs, and other documentation, organized and divided by handwritten tabs, and I think the quantity of information assembled has more than doubled since then. Sarah can't remember where she first heard about the two murdered West Virginia University freshmen growing up. It was after another murder that she first began looking into the story of Merritt and Karen.
Neither of my parents went to college, but I do remember them talking about someone was headless in Cameron. So when I started thinking about the two, I'm like, we've got these two headless co-eds, and we've got this body that I've heard about in Cameron. Maybe I should see if there's some kind of serial killer that I didn't know about. I was trying to connect it to something else. I didn't even know that there had been a trial at that point. I didn't know that there was someone who was convicted for the crime. So when I started digging into the information, one of the first things I saw was, well, there was someone apprehended for it. And it sounded like it was a very emotional verdict, not really based on facts. I mean, for me personally, it didn't add up for me. The way that the bodies were found, they were completely fully clothed, but their heads were missing. That sounds like a sexual crime, but these girls were found like they'd just fallen over like that. It just didn't make sense to me. It kind of grabbed a hold of me, and I'm like, this can't be an isolated event. It latched onto my imagination.
Her fiancé was in Spain for 2 weeks, so she had lots of time to research these cases. That's when she discovered a post on websleuths.com. It was a post by a user named Geocam, asking for anyone who remembered anything related to the deaths of Merritt and Karen to contact him. The problem was that the post was 10 years old. She read through the comments, but knew there was little chance that Geocam even used the same email address, much less was still following up on replies to the site. Later on, Sarah found a novel that had been written, not about the girl's murder specifically, but which was set in the same city and drew on various details of the case. The author, our other host, Jeffrey Cameron Fuller, that's Jeffrey with a G, Geocam. She put the names together and got in touch. It turns out Jeff had not only grown up in the area, but had been following the case, to some degree, since before he was even an adult.
After one man was arrested and tried for the crime, I went to the trial when I was in high school. I skipped high school and went to parts of the trial.
What made you decide to skip high school to go to the trial of someone that had committed murders years earlier?
Well, let me think. Which one's more interesting?
The reason Jeff had made the post 10 years previous was research for a detailed nonfiction about the WVU murders. Even as you hear Jeff talk about this case on this podcast, the book is still being written. By the time our last episode is released, we hope to have more information about how you can get a hold of that book. As a teenager, Jeff had gone out of his way to cross paths with the case, and many years later, the case found him.
I'd gotten married and I was living down in Charleston and teaching classes, and an older gentleman came and took the class. Turned out he was Richard Hall, who was retired from the West Virginia State Police, and he wanted to investigate the crime. He had testified early on. He had been one of the first ones to take confessions and so forth. And so he came to me and said, I want to write a book. I don't think I'm capable of that. Why don't you write the book and I'll finish the investigation? So from that time on, for the next 4 or 5 years, I had shadowed Richard as he was investigating the crime. So that's why I have so much stuff about it and learned so much about what actually happened.
Over the course of our story, we'll talk to a musician, a lawyer, a crime reporter, a West Virginia broadcasting legend, a photojournalist who was actually there the day the bodies were discovered, possibly others. This is a work in progress, and we're constantly discovering new sources and information. But Sarah and Jeff are going to be our primary guides through the grisly story of Merritt Malerick and Karen Farrell. So, what kind of murders are still talked about 45 years later? Well, let's get started. Our story begins in the mountain town that is currently the home of Chromatic Media and where Jeff grew up, Morgantown, West Virginia. Despite its small size, Morgantown is now one of the larger cities in the state, best known for being home of West Virginia University. Sarah, who lived in Morgantown in her 20s, says that there are a number of reasons to like the place.
I like that it's small town, but it's also got the amenities of the closest thing you'll find to a city around here. You have some live music, which is kind of difficult to find anywhere else that's not honky-tonk. And you can get craft beer. You don't have to settle for Bud Light and Bud as your only two choices. You have 24-hour open conveniences, not just Walmart. It's your center for convenience.
Now, while this story does take place in Morgantown, it also takes place in 1970. And Jeff says that 1970 Morgantown is a different story.
Yeah, and what Sarah was saying about all those amenities and 24-hour thing, all that, there was nothing like that here in 1970 or even maybe as late as 1980. I worked in the one all-night coffee shop. It was unbelievably different. There were no interstates. Construction hadn't even started. Everything was small, two-lane, windy roads connecting Morgantown to anything else outside of Morgantown.
I was actually a senior in 1968. In 1970, I was working for the Dominion News.
This is our first guest, Evelyn Ryan. As she says, she worked for the Dominion News, one of Morgantown's two newspapers, reporting on the story of Merritt and Karen at the time. She concurs with Jeff about the city's drastically different character.
It had about 29,000 people in it and another 13,000 students. There was no mall. No interstates, no four lanes. just two bridges across the river, which we still have, basically.
Evelyn says that Morgantown was different not only in terms of size and amenities, but also in its social and political atmosphere on campus.
The late 60s, when I was on campus, there was a great deal of revolt going on. In 1966, when I arrived, was the first year of the Festival of Ideas, and I came on campus to just an overwhelming amount of things signifying a university that have since gone. There were speakers, there were assemblies. There were also an organized group of students that were trying to get a student code of conduct passed because there were a number of restrictions on female students. For example, a guy who wanted to stay out all night could stay out all night, wander in about 4 o'clock in the morning and crash in bed and not worry about anything. A girl had to be in. There were hours. I think it was the year I arrived. They lifted the raincoat ban. So you could show up with slacks or shorts without wearing a raincoat over them.
Despite the progressive direction of student life on campuses, the optimism accompanying the social changes of the 1960s was quickly dying throughout the rest of the country by January of 1970. A month earlier, the Grateful Dead had refused to take the stage at the countercultural Altamont Free Festival, as good vibes turned into a day of violence, culminating in the beating and stabbing of an 18-year-old by Hell's Angels right in front of the stage. The Manson family was about to go on trial, and while Morgantown was not a big city by any stretch of the imagination, a major crime wave was sweeping the area.
Kenneth Carter was a WVU student. He was found bludgeoned to death on the grounds of University High School.
There was an attempted assassination in 67 of a man named Carl Tommy Scavariello. He was shot 3 times from another car while he was driving his car.
There had been a bombing of police headquarters.
There was a murder of Anthony Scotchell in 1968. He was shot 4 times in the head and stuffed in the trunk of his Cadillac. He was found in a parking lot in a Pittsburgh hotel room.
Jocko Iblonski, he and his wife and child were murdered just north of Morgantown. Gambling was the big issue that kept coming up over and over again. So there's a lot of nervousness about crime in the area.
They weren't particularly being solved, was the problem.
Right.
There was a lot of rampant crime, but it wasn't being resolved.
Just 2 weeks before the murders of Merritt and Karen, this surge of violence hit a crescendo with the attempted assassination of a local prosecutor named Joseph Lorita Jr.
He was a real crusader. He was 32 years old, very young prosecuting attorney, considered very handsome, you know, had a lot of attention at the time, and he was bringing a lot of indictments. Okay, on January 2nd, he got in his car to go to work, and it was, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, and turned the ignition key, and it blew up.
That's technically not been solved.
Right, technically not solved.
Here we introduce our next guest, Ron Rittenhouse, a Morgantown photographer who also worked for the Dominion News at that time and who will come back into our story in episode 2. He remembers in detail the day of the bombing of Joseph Lorita.
I finished my stuff for the morning and was coming back to the Greer building and saw this police car rush by. So I'm finished with everything, so I'll just follow it and see what's going on. So as I was going down through there, I saw this small compact car and it was smoking and things like that. So quite naturally, I went over to see what was going on. Morgantown police officer Bill Hughes, big guy, you know, 6'7", 8", you know, 350 pounds, you know, standing beside me. He looked like he was so big, you know. So I walk up, oh, what's going on? I knew him. What's going on, Bill? Ron, can't really say much. And as I walk over to this car, you know, I'm taking pictures. Bill says, well, you can't go over there. Well, anyway, I went over, and while I was there with start taking pictures, this voice came out and said, Ron, if you take any pictures of me or this car, I'll see you in the newspaper. When this voice came out, I was right by the car, you know, and I knew there was something in there, but I assumed the person was dead because it was a horrible looking scene, you know. Of course, I had no idea who it was at the time, so I kind of stepped back, and then I get back to the building and down the hallway, walk in to process my film, and our publisher came running down, pounding on the door. Prosecuting attorney has just been bombed on the Swabia Avenue, you know. That's when I found out it was a prosecuting attorney, Joe Larita. So that was kind of, for a newspaper photographer and news like that, that's, you know, you're right there on the scene, and that was a great time for Simon and the other people who wasn't so great.
It may seem incredible that Larita survived this, at least it does to me, but it turns out that it's actually more incredible Larita's wife wasn't killed.
He had some serious burns and damage to his legs. And from what I understand, his wife used to get in the car with him every morning. He would take her to town. And normally, she would be getting in. They put the dynamite, from what I understand later, on the driver's side. Well, dynamite doesn't blow straight back. It blows to the left or to the right. So if she would have been in there that morning, it got the bottom of his legs and it blew out the right passenger side of the car, so she probably would have been killed.
While crime in the city had been on the increase, something like the bombing of a head prosecutor was unprecedented. It was 16 days later that Meriden Karen disappeared. One of the things that's difficult for 21st century observers to understand about the girls' disappearances is how little the public actually heard about the girls' personal lives afterward. This is why you heard Sarah excited at the beginning of the show to find out that Jeff had found her class schedule, because every little bit of information about Merritt and Karen can illuminate a little more about who they were. If two freshman college girls were decapitated today, the news networks would be covering every conceivable detail of their lives, their family life, their upbringing, studies at school, their boyfriends, their hopes and dreams. But in 1970, things were different.
On paper, Karen and Merritt were very vaguely discussed by the media. They didn't really go into their personal lives like you would have today. Karen and Merritt were just described as girls that were going to WVU. We didn't really talk about their hopes or their dreams or their hobbies or interests. I know that Karen was adopted. She was from Quinwood, West Virginia. Merritt was the youngest of three, and she was from Kennelin, New Jersey. There really wasn't a whole lot reported outside of that.
Despite not knowing many intimate details about the girls themselves, we do know about the night they went missing.
This was January 18th, 1970. This was a Sunday.
It was kind of a chilly day that Sunday, January 18th, 1970.
Their second semester had just started. Everybody had been back for a week and a half.
And the girls were going from their dorm room, which was Westchester Hall, and they're walking down to the Superette. From the Superette, they go to the movie Oliver, which is playing at the Metropolitan Theater, which is on High Street downtown.
They went to see Oliver approximately 7 o'clock, the early showing of the movie Oliver, which is a long movie apparently at the time, 3.5 hours, something like that.
It's a long movie today.
Yeah, and they had intermissions back then, which they don't really do much here.
Was that like a 15-minute intermission? Or?
It's a smoke break is what it is.
For the projectionist.
For everybody. I mean, they're probably, my dad said in classrooms, the air was thick with smoke.
During this intermission, Merritt introduced Karen to two acquaintances known as Skip and Itzy. The girls had been sitting a row behind them. And let me digress one final time here to address our use of the word girls, even though they were technically adults.
By the way, the use of the term girl here is not meant to be derogatory. That's what everyone said at the time. That wouldn't be appropriate now because everyone was 18, 19, whatever. But back then, they were girls.
So Merritt, Karen, Skip, and Itzy all go back into the theater and watch the second half of Oliver.
When they left the theater, they all four left together.
Got up to a high of 41 degrees, and the low for the evening was 16. So the girls getting out of the movie theater and wanting to walk back, get back to their dorm at 11 o'clock at night, it was getting to be rather chilly.
And they walked up High Street, and they skipped, it was about a block and a half, and they There's a scene in the movie Oliver where consider yourself at home.
Consider yourself at home. Consider yourself one of the family. I've taken to you so strong. It's clear we're going to get along. Consider yourself.
And they're skipping, and it's a musical, and, you know, so they're doing this, and they're doing that scene as they go up the street. By this time, the rains turn to snow pretty exclusively, and Skip and Itzy decide that they're going to take the bus, and Merritt and Karen say, oh, no, we're going to hitchhike.
The girls found a ride almost immediately. Skip turned back to glance at them as they piled into what was described as a light-colored sedan.
He had turned around to look for the girls, and he saw them talking to the driver, and then he saw Merritt sit beside the driver, and Karen sat on the other side of her, and they were all in the front seat. And when they drove past, he said it was odd that they weren't making eye contact or even pretending to know that he was there.
Maybe they just didn't think of it, you know, it doesn't necessarily. But, I mean, I've heard that before, and Clarence did say, they were looking at us.
Well, they had sat together the second half of the movie. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, there was already this rapport, even though they had just met Skip. You know, it would be kind of odd not to wave when you see them.
That was the last time the girls were seen alive. Barely 2 hours went by before they were reported missing.
According to this paper, at 1:15 a.m., they were reported to the Morgantown police as missing. Their curfew was midnight, and some of their friends at the dorm were complaining it wasn't like them to not be back by curfew at midnight.
Yeah, in fact, friends of the dorm had kind of gathered in a little lounge area on the fourth floor of Westchester and were talking about, you know, where could Karen be, where could Merritt be, because that wasn't like them. Karen sometimes was reported to have come in late, sometimes a little tipsy, but it wasn't like them to just not show. You know, it's not the same as being 15 minutes late. So they were very worried. And the way the police reports read, everyone was awake and wondering where they were.
But it turns out this had been a particularly crazy night for the freshman girls of WVU.
The next day, two other co-eds were reported missing. And a third girl, freshman, from WVU was reported missing also that night. So there were actually five people missing. Five female freshmen from WVU the same night. Plus, this was a time when everybody hitchhiked everywhere. So there were hitchhiking people all over the place. And so the descriptions of Merritt and Karen were such that, I mean, those descriptions could pretty reasonably fit most anyone who's 18, 19 years old.
24 hours went by with no word from the girls, then 48 hours, then a week. While everyone who knew the girls, and most who didn't, suspected foul play, the police seemed to be operating under the assumption that they had simply left town. This was, after all, a generation that had grown up with the faces of Allen Ginsberg and Timothy Leary flickering on black and white television sets.
We tell young people today, drop out of school, because schools, education today, is the worst narcotic drug of all. Don't politic, don't vote. These are old men's games, impotent and senile old men that want to put you onto their old chess games of war and power. Drop out. Tune in with natural things. Take off your shoes, get back in tune with God's harmony, surround yourself with beauty and sacred objects. You can't get caught in the conforming, rote lockstep, which we call American society.
Merritt had written to one of her friends before that she was thinking about taking a couple of days just to herself. So I think they were running with that assumption that they didn't want to be found.
Not only that, but if you have a... things like this just don't happen in the area. You got five girls go missing, three come back. Maybe the other two are just off on a lark.
Merritt had also written a letter 2 days before they disappeared that didn't indicate anything like she's going to take off or anything. She just was feeling the blahs of, winter in Morgantown.
The one where she says it feels like a morgue.
Yeah, she said, it feels like a morgue was the sentence she spoke of Morgantown.
This, of course, turned out to be more accurate than she possibly could have known at the time. Before it had even been determined just how grotesque and strange the disappearance of Merritt and Karen would become, the community, especially WVU students, began to rally, demanding that an investigation be taken seriously.
The first mention of petitions was on January 25th, a week after Merritt and Karen disappeared. Two officers were talking with students and members of the faculty, and apparently they were dissatisfied with the investigation already within a week, and plans were being made to circulate a petition. They got 2,700 signatures altogether.
Now, this petition not only expressed dissatisfaction with the way that the investigation was progressing, which is to say that it wasn't progressing, but it also demanded two things. The first was what I'll call hitchhiking reform. Now, it was already illegal to hitchhike in the city of Morgantown, but because the university did not provide transportation to and from residence halls, it was almost a necessity for students.
No buses. No car. No money for cab. It's cold. I don't want to walk. Out goes the thumb.
As Evelyn says, tons of people did it, and most people who did it needed to. The city wasn't about to start beef with thousands of parents and WVU, which was and is a major financial player in Morgantown, by locking up or fining half of the student population, and so the ban wasn't enforced. Merritt's roommate, who declined an invitation to speak with us, was at the forefront of this petitioning and push. The newspaper quoted her as saying,
"If this doesn't show students that hitchhiking should be banned, then I feel sorry for them. I can't see how these students can say it's not going to happen to me. I'm sure those two girls never thought anything like this was ever going to happen to them."
I mentioned to Sarah and Jeff that my generation, growing up, always heard that you never hitchhike, that these days it's just sort of taken for granted that it's dangerous. And I asked them whether this was the story that made that idea mainstream in this area.
Well, see, that depends on who you asked. Because my sister maintains, nobody hitchhiked after that, but I said, I hitchhiked all through junior high and high school, and everybody I knew did. I mean, there's still plenty of hitchhiking going on.
How about females that you knew?
Not so much.
I think that's a different situation. When you're a male, you probably don't have the same trepidation towards it that you would as a female.
Regardless, looking into the girl's disappearance made it clear that some disturbing things were going on.
As the police were investigating, they discovered a lot of WVU women who had been picked up by various people, and a couple of people said some nasty things to them and seemed threatening to them. And then some of them were considered jokes among the freshman girls who were talking about that sort of thing. That guy's just he's harmless. He just talks strange. And so that kind of thing was just, everybody was hitchhiking. There's a lot of hitchhiking. There were a lot of people picking up people. And out of that, when it began to get investigated closely by the police, they started looking closer and finding that there were a lot of strange people doing the picking up, scaring people. So all these things were kind of in the air and talked about by city council and talked about by WVU administration and by students, trying to figure out some way to not have so many people hitchhiking.
But one of the side effects of that was, with it being such a big, hey, nobody's allowed to hitchhike, that meant whenever something strange happened, whenever something scary happened, they were more reluctant to come and tell WVU what happened because they didn't want to get a lecture about how you're not supposed to hitchhike.
Nevertheless, out of all of this, eventually, came a number of important changes, and maybe some not so important ones.
There are phones now on WVU, emergency phones.
Yeah,
people can call.
Lights.
All that came directly out of the co-ed thing, as did better bus service from the university and various effects.
This was just sort of something that was mentioned when I was a freshman at WVU that the steps, and I have no idea, like, to the validation of the story, but the steps were designed as rape steps, so they're easier for women to climb than men.
That just sounds dumb to me.
They were pretty hard for me to climb. They were very tiny.
The other, more important thing that the petitions demanded was the involvement of the FBI in the search for Merritt and Karen. Police records we now have access to make it clear that the FBI was present almost from the very beginning, even if they weren't actually doing much. They were in town anyway, checking into that whole Laredo bombing assassination attempt we mentioned earlier. Students were at the forefront of demands for FBI involvement, but they were supported by the greater Morgantown community.
The Morgantown Area Chamber of Commerce and I believe the City Council both wrote letters to Governor Archmore saying that they thought that the FBI should be involved and the police needed assistance.
However, the FBI declined because there was no evidence of interstate commerce of any kind. Nobody crossed state lines. These are the kinds of things that the FBI at the time needed to get into an investigation.
There were sometimes leads that took investigators out of town and even out of the state. One person called the police with information that the girls had been spotted hitchhiking with truckers.
They had to go from basically from trucker to trucker and then track these girls, and they found them in Kentucky.
Needless to say, they turned out not to be Merritt and Karen, and there were many other dead-end leads and pseudo-leads provided by people who were hoping to claim the reward money that had been offered or to just be involved in something important, but nothing that would permit the FBI to become active. So after a long lull, this is the moment in the story when things really start to happen quickly. This is the end of March, so 2.5 months had gone by with basically no working leads in the case, or so the public thought. Not long before this, Karen's parents had visited her dorm room to clean out her belongings. It seemed they had finally given up on her ever returning to WVU. On the 25th of March, Governor Moore, aware of the increasing restlessness of the population, orders the two West Virginia State Police who were again in town looking into the assassination attempt to start looking into the disappearance of the co-eds. It's around this time that the WVU students took one of these petitions we've been talking about to the president of WVU, President James Harlow, who immediately scheduled them a meeting with the governor himself.
And they met with the governor in April, first week of April.
It's in this meeting that Governor Moore discloses something that up to this point, the public doesn't know. The authorities had discovered Merritt Malarick's purse.
There was a kid named Stephen Trickett, and he lived about 10 or 12 miles south of Morgantown. And he was collecting pop bottles. You could return pop bottles for deposits at the time and get a nickel, I think it was. And so that's what he was looking for, a way to make some extra money. And so he's wandering up by the road and looking for stuff people have thrown out of the car. And about 50 feet off the road, he sees a purse. It's soaking wet. And he looks in it, and there's 13 cents and a receipt.
So the police call Merritt's roommate to ask her to identify that this was indeed Merritt's purse, but she's out of town. After figuring out how to get in contact with her by phone, she tells them that it just so happens that she and Merritt have the same purse and that hers is still in the dorm room. They check it, and it matches. This revelation does not help the public feel better about the progress of the investigation. The purse had been found on March 1st, more than a month earlier. As Jeff was first telling me the story of the discovery of the purse, I assumed that it had made the Morgantown police begin to treat Merritt and Karen's disappearance as a kidnapping. That was apparently not the case, as he then told me this story about the day the state police had arrived on the governor's orders.
And hopefully at this point, people are starting to, you know, not be swayed by this off on a lark idea. Or you're giving me a not so sure about that face.
Well, the story I heard from a law enforcement source, the purse was sitting on a filing cabinet, and that was the first thing he fixed on as he comes in the police, and he said, "What is that doing there? Is that the purse they found?" And when told, yes, it was. So it's one of those, belongs to one of those girls that ran away. He apparently hit the roof and was not happy.
We should reiterate here that this story is hearsay, even though it's from a law enforcement source, and is the only part of our narrative for which we have no direct evidence. In any case, the public felt much the same way when it heard that this lead had been discovered more than a month earlier. The newspaper that our previous guests, Evelyn and Ron, worked for, the Dominion News, began to openly attack the competence of the police and accuse the governor of filtering information. The governor's office replied that they had made the news public 2 weeks earlier. This was then responded to by the managing editor, who printed a story inviting the governor's aide to tell him which of the local papers the news had been shared with, since no such news had ever been heard, saying, quote, "It would be most enlightening." The day before the petition was delivered to the governor, the state police had finally organized helicopter reconnaissance in the area that the purse was found. Two choppers flew over a wide area south of Morgantown, searching for anything unusual. But as we've mentioned, West Virginia is a heavily forested state, and these flights had turned up nothing. Then, on April 9th, one of the strangest parts of Merritt and Karen's story begins to unfold. It was on that day that the police received a letter, postmarked the previous day in Cumberland, Maryland, 75 miles east of Morgantown. It read as follows.
"Gentlemen, I have information on the whereabouts of the bodies of two missing West Virginia University co-eds, Merritt Mallorick and Karen Farrell. Follow the directions very carefully, to the nth degree, and you cannot fail to find them. Proceed 25 miles directly south from the southern line of Morgantown. This will bring you to a wooded forest land. Enter into the forest exactly 1 mile. There are the bodies. 25 plus 1 equals 26 total miles. Will reveal myself when the bodies are located."
The letter was signed not with a name, but with a symbol, a triangle. That's all for episode 1 of Appalachian Mysteria, the WVU co-ed murders. In episode 2, the girls' belongings start to turn up in scattered piles. More letters arrive from the mysterious triangle, the National Guard is called in, and a shockwave of panic and rumor hit Morgantown as the headless bodies of Merritt and Karen are finally discovered. You can find Chromatic Media and the WVU co-ed murders on Facebook and at coedmurders.com. If you enjoy the show, take 2 seconds to rate it on your favorite podcasting service to help other listeners find good stuff. Season 1 of Appalachian Mysteria is produced by myself and Sarah Gibbons, with lots of assistance by Jeff Fuller. Our theme song, which you can hear right now, along with other instrumental tracks, were written and recorded by Nick Larson, John Smithers, Annie Stroud, and Nathan Snyder. Our soundtrack is comprised entirely of songs by Morgantown musicians. First up, we had Daddy Longlegs from Haggard Wolf. Veil 5 from Ordo Templi Sonica. Bob Shank with Roller Snake. Finally, Jet Set Vapor Trails with Nymphs of Dirt.
Hey,
The letter from Triangle was voiced by Justin Groh. Special thanks to our guests, Evelyn Ryan and Ron Rittenhouse. Ron will be returning in episode 2 to talk about the day Merritt and Karen's bodies were discovered when police confiscated his film. The story just gets wilder. Stay tuned. The speaker's got a new pump, we speed it blast through.